Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series which looks at science fiction from all angles, covering the past, the present, and the future. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And we're recording in late January 2024, so we're in the future now. And today we're going to review something a bit unusual. It's a novel, but it was written not for print, but for performance as a full cast audio production. More on that in a minute or two. Later on, we'll have our usual recommendations of past, present and future science fiction. And we might possibly have a quiz. But first, some feedback from listeners. We always like to hear from you, so please post your comments on Facebook, where you will find us as Science Fiction 101 Podcast, or on our blog at 101sf.blogspot.com. So a couple of postings from listeners. Paul responded when he saw that we were going to be reviewing New Worlds magazine. And he said, "I'll be interested to see what you make of this issue. The later large sizes were a cross between an impenetrable literary quarterly and Pravda." And in brackets, he says, "Read some of the didactic party line reviews. This issue might just be before the cusp." So I don't know. I think impenetrable literary journal or quarterly or whatever it was. That sounds fairly close to what we read. Paul also gave us an interesting little factoid, which is that it wasn't Michael Moorcock's choice to include the Samuel R. Delaney story, which is the story that we thought was the best one in the issue. He says it was actually James Salis, who is the kind of deputy editor who chose that story, and that Michael Moorcock wouldn't have chosen it because he didn't like it. Amazing. No accounting for taste. We also heard from Sue, and Sue wrote, "Colin and Phil, I greatly enjoyed your looks at Galaxy and Clark's World, both from about 2 years ago, and look forward to hearing this episode about Uncanny," which of course was our previous episode from this. Sue says, "My love of science fiction came from my dad, and I now have at least some of his collection of mags." And she attached a photo, or a couple of photos, of some boxes of old magazines. And one of them was for the magazine Unknown, which was a title that disappeared as a result of the Second World War paper shortage. And Sue says, "The March 1939 issue of Unknown has a story by Eric Frank Russell, whose 1950 novelette Dear Devil is beautiful. I have a marshmallow heart and love stories in which aliens and humans become good friends, e.g., of course, Project Hail Mary," which of course we've reviewed some time ago, "but also Zena Henderson's lovely and gentle Subcommittee." And Sue finishes with, "Thanks for your great cast." It's cast with an apostrophe. I call it a pod, but some people call it a cast. So thanks for writing in, folks. Keep the comments coming. We always love to hear from you. Now on to our main topic, which is to review The Downloaded by Robert J. Sawyer, which is an Audible original. That means it's an audiobook first, before it is a print book. So, Colin, are you up for doing a plot summary?
Sure. I'll try and give it a go.
Okay.
Some interstellar astronauts enter suspended animation in order to make a long trip, which is supposed to take 500 years of real time, but awaken to find out that they aren't where they thought they were going to be.
Oh, very good. But there's a lot more to it, isn't there?
There's quite a bit more. And we'll get into that as we talk about individual plot points.
Okay. Before we go into those details, what's your overall impression of The Downloaded? Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. It's a full cast audio recording, and I really, really like that in an audiobook. I don't listen to a lot of audiobooks, but when I do, I prefer a full cast recording. A lot of it has to do with character distinction, because when it's just one person trying to do different tones and accents and rhythms of speaking to talk about one character versus another, Not all people have that ability to do very well. So when you have physically different people doing different characters, that I like that a lot.
Yeah. And I think you said to me that you thought there were quite a few science fictional ideas piled on top of each other.
Yeah, I realized at one point, and it was about halfway or two-thirds of the book, that we were really playing sci-fi bingo. There are 13 or 14 different sci-fi topics in this one book, which in a future book, I guess you'd kind of expect, but maybe not to this degree. I mean, they had consciousness upload, quantum computing, cryonics, interstellar travel. This story is post-apocalyptic. There's human evolution, artificial intelligence, a coronal mass injection that they think hits the Earth, a nuclear war, which definitely hits the Earth. There's Asimov's laws and robotic murder, Martian settlement, asteroid impact, and to sum it up, a remotely projected hologram.
What more could you want?
I guess unless you did like blasters or lightsabers or something else. I mean,
that's a lot of stuff. Thanks for listening to Science Fiction 101. That's all we have time for today.
I like the overall story. The ending seemed a little, I guess, cheesy is the word I'm looking for.
I thought you were going to say rushed.
Well, yeah. No, it was definitely cheesy. Just because, you know, everything turns out all right in the end. And that doesn't always happen in the situations that occur in this book.
Right. Fair enough. I, too, love a full cast audio thing. I'm a particular fan of audio drama as opposed to audio books. I mean, I do listen to audio books, but I find it very difficult to concentrate on an audio book where it's just one reader. So like you, I like multiple readers, but I prefer full drama to just multiple narrators. But I thought this was an interesting hybrid. It was sort of not, it was, to make it sound negative, it was neither one thing nor the other. But I don't really mean that as a negative. It isn't someone reading a book, and it isn't a full drama, but it is somewhere in between, and I thought that made it interesting. But yeah, like you, I thought it was a bit overloaded with science fictional ideas. I didn't count up where they appeared. I mean, if they were equally rationed through every episode, it might have been okay, but I felt that that wasn't what was happening. It was more that things were being piled in as we go, and it was almost every couple of minutes, it was, oh, here's another science fiction concept. But there were some specifics that I thought were good. I particularly liked the first episode because that established the complete failure of what we might call conventional cryogenics. So the idea that somebody dies, you freeze their body, and when the cure is found for whatever killed them, you thaw them out and you give them the cure, and hey, they're back alive again. But what this story shows or suggests is that's not going to happen, because what happens is they do have a man who is thawed out, and he is brought back to life, and he's kept alive very successfully. Unfortunately, he has no consciousness, and no matter what they do, they cannot bring his consciousness back. So this then leads to the idea that you have to separate, more or less separate the mind from the body, and you put the consciousness into a quantum computer, because the conceit of the story is minds work through some strange quantum means. So put the mind in the quantum computer, freeze the body, and then when the time comes, you can reunite the two elements. And I thought the whole business around that grandfather who is revived, but it's not him because it is just a body. It's a living body, but it's just a body. I thought all of that was very, very moving and emotionally done. And I thought that was a really good start to the story, because you think it's going in a particular direction at that point, but then it says, aha, no, there's going to be a problem, and it swerves off in this other direction. I thought that was rather good. And of course, once you've got the consciousness in a computer, You know what you can do with computers, don't you, Colin?
You can overclock them.
Yes, that's exactly what I thought.
Or in this case, underclock them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they decide that they're going to use this technology for interstellar travel, and they launch a ship, or they're going to launch a ship, out towards a distant star system that has a planet they think they could eventually terraform, maybe. And they're going to do this by underclocking the quantum clock, and so that while it might be 500 years, it's only going to be 4 years subjectively for the people on the ship.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. And they decide that this technology is so unique, they're going to try and also attack the prison problem by taking prisoners with long sentences that are probably rehabable and overclock them so that while they might only spend 10 months in prison, they can have a 20, 30, or 40 year prison sentence.
Yeah. So that I thought that was interesting, again, to take these two possible consequences of the idea of being stored in a computer and exploring both of them and then bringing all of that together later on in the story. So I thought that was nicely done. It did remind me of a Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode where Chief O'Brien is punished by some aliens for something that they think he's done. And they basically lock him up. In real time, I think he's only in there for a couple of days. But in his mind, he's been in there for like 30 years. So he thinks he's been in solitary confinement for 30 years. But it's actually just been a couple of days. So it's the same basic concept.
That also reminds me of that particular Deep Space Nine episode reminds me of the Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, we believe that the chief is completely innocent. But while he's, you know, in this hologrammatic artificial consciousness state, he actually commits crimes that he then, you know, carries the burden for when he's all done.
Right. Yeah.
So he had to go to jail to be a criminal.
Yes, that's right. What did you think of the central character? There's one character who is slightly more central than the others, and that's I think he's called Kadulian.
Roscoe.
And he's played by Brendan Fraser, who's, yes, the Oscar-winning actor. And I wondered if this was going to be another George of the Jungle role or a mummy role for him. But fortunately, it's not. It's more in keeping with his current status as Oscar winner for The Whale. But I thought he ultimately created a very likable character. It's somebody who starts off as a murderer, as far as our knowledge of them is concerned, start off as a murderer, but then is redeemed really by the end of the story, because he becomes the sort of the mayor of the town that the downloaded, all the various people who've been stored in a quantum computer are all downloaded into thawed out bodies. And he becomes their sort of elected leader.
We should take a half step back because the summary I gave was very, very brief. The entire experiment, the prison experiment and the interstellar travel experiments, fail because the ship never leaves Earth.
Yeah.
And there's a limited nuclear war. And so the entire staff of the, you know, the quantum facility dies.
Yes.
And so the only reason they ever wake up is the crew is programmed to come out, and the prisoners who are in suspension, in prison quite a bit longer than they had told they would be, all get thawed at the same time.
Yep.
Except for one person. One person's cryo crypt has been smashed in and their head caved in.
So they've got nowhere to go, basically.
They can't come out originally.
Yeah.
But then Valentina decides that she... Oh, gosh, this is so... so there, all these people are trapped on an Earth that is trapped... that is approximately in the... It's post-apocalyptic. It's kind of like Planet of the Apes. Although instead of apes, they have Mennonites. And they don't have a lot of them. They just have at least one isolated band.
Yeah.
So they can't go anywhere. And... An astronomer who was on the ship in suspended animation again had realized that there is a gigantic asteroid which is going to hit the Earth They call the asteroid Brimstone, and it is large enough it's going to liquefy the crust and destroy all life on Earth in 7 years.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that, and, you know, of all the other things that are going on in the story, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. So some of the people decide they're going to, you know, stay in real life. A couple of people decide, yes, no, put me back in the quantum computer and super clock it, and I'll be able to live like 168 years, relatively speaking. And because Valentina so despises being in a male body, that's what she chooses. And so there's this whole heartbreak story between her and Roscoe.
Right. And then can I lay in another complication to the story?
Sure.
And that is where the whole thing is told through interviews with the various characters. And I think it's about episode 4 or 5 that we finally discover who it is who's doing the interviewing. And it turns out they're Martians. Well, except they're Martians who used to be people. They've been on Mars for hundreds of years, and of course, they're not used to Earth gravity because they grew up in lower gravity, so they can't actually land on Earth. So I think they're sort of projected, aren't they? Holographic projections or something, while they stay in orbit. And, oh, yeah, it all gets... for me, that's when it all got a little bit too overlaid with one idea on top of another.
Yeah. I enjoyed that reveal.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, at first, I thought the narrator of the story who announces the chapter headings and who we're going to be speaking to, I thought it was just, you know, a red thing in a neutral voice to be science fiction-y.
Yeah.
And then I thought it would be one of the robots that were attending the quantum computing facility. Once they revealed that we're actually talking and interacting with somebody.
Yeah.
That was a huge thing. And then I wanted to know more, and I thought it was aliens. And then it turns out, like you said, all right, it's not really aliens. It's evolved Earthlings. And
yeah. Who incidentally have been to Proxima Centauri, which is where the original mission was due to go. And didn't they say it's a hell hole or something?
Yeah.
So yeah, what, I mean, what the a small odds of, world.
Yeah. I think it's probably worse than the Earth is, though.
Yeah. I did quite like the storytelling overall in the sense of it being presented as this series of interviews. I thought that enabled it to get away from having a narrator. And I'm curious now to see the print version of the novel, which is coming out later this year, because I want to see whether it's going to be presented more or less exactly as we've heard it, or whether there is going to be a kind of a narrational over voice. I don't know what to call it, a kind of a dominating voice that sort of ties it all together. But I did like the fact that we were cutting backwards and forwards between different interviews. That made it very enjoyable.
Yeah, I liked it. Oh, and then originally it starts off being only interviews. And then I thought at one point that the style changed and it became a little more narrative with multiple people interacting with one another.
Yeah, yeah.
So instead of just having one person read one section, so to say, there's, you know, interleaved discussions and...
Yes, that's right. And that becomes a bit more dramatic, I think, when that happens. What did you think of all the film references that were in there? It seemed hardly 10 minutes went by without somebody making some reference to Casablanca or Planet of the Apes or something else. And even when they weren't making references, things were happening science fictionally that made me think, that's Logan's Run. Or, as you said, Planet of the Apes or any number of other things. So what did you think of its sort of awareness of film?
You know, I think that's an important thing because it really roots it in, you know, our universe, so to say.
Yeah.
Something that Seth mentioned to me, he said, you know, think about near-term science fiction. And when was the last time somebody mentioned Star Wars or Star Trek? And a lot of them don't. They're put off in this own thing off to the side, and there's no connection back to us.
Yeah.
And given that this was near-term science fiction, some of the characters in it should recognize the cultural references of, oh, this is like Casablanca, this is like Planet of the Apes. They should recognize directors and actors. And so I thought it was a nice tie-in to that whole thing. And
yeah, it certainly felt more real. felt like when you're having a conversation with friends, rather than reading a piece of intellectual property where somebody is afraid to make references for fear that they're violating a trademark or something.
I'd never thought about that. You think they'd be... You think everyone would like a nod, so to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to think they would, but I think the lawyers would see an opportunity to get some money. You know, if you made... Not from this book, but if you made this into a movie, for example, or a Netflix series, how many of those references can you have before people start saying, "Wait a minute, you're trading on our property"?
Which is why you don't see a lot of movies like Ready Player One.
Yeah, yeah.
Where every, you know, the whole thing is about the properties.
Yes. Yeah.
Crazy. I hadn't even considered that.
It was the first thing I thought of, really. But no, it was fun. I thought it added a fun human dimension to it. And if anything, it might make this whole Audible original accessible to more people. So people who perhaps don't really do audiobooks so much might be tempted to this one because of, well, it's got a star actor in it, for example. And knowing that it is... dramatized rather than a straight reading, it may attract people to it who normally wouldn't go for an audiobook. So
yeah, well, and Robert J. Sawyer is no slouch as an author either.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think what he's very good at, both here and in the other books of his that I've read, is he's very good at considering all of the consequences of the science and technology in his story. So he will choose the little science fictional hook, which in this case is storing consciousness in a quantum computer. And then he will think, what is the consequence of that? But not just one consequence, he thinks of all of them. And then he explores the whole territory. And that's why we've got these two extreme groups of people in the story, the people who are thinking they're going off to Proxima Centauri and the people who are imprisoned. You know, they're two totally unconnected groups of people who ultimately have to get on with each other because they're the only humans left alive. But they both are in the circumstance they're in because of the consequence of the putting consciousness in quantum computing. Don't know if I'm explaining that very well, but it's exploring all of those possible outcomes of a technical decision.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a couple of things I thought were stretched just a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have never closely studied the distribution patterns of nuclear radiation after a war.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it hard to believe that there would be isolated pockets that would have no radiation.
Mm.
Especially when you consider like watersheds.
Yeah.
And other issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea that the Mennonite population would have survived a nuclear war, I find hard to believe.
Yeah, I suppose. I was thinking of it more in terms of people in cities would have been obliterated, and people out of cities may well be affected by the radiation, the fallout and so on, but they're not going to be directly hit. So it might be a more long-term thing. But yeah, you're right. The Mennonites in this do seem to be unaffected by the whole thing. But... I quite like that idea that those Mennonites are the best hope for humankind. And the book does have, I mean, the Audible original, whatever we want to call it. It
yeah.
does put pacifism front and center in the story. And I thought that was great because a lot of science fiction is about wars and is militaristic. And although there are some elements of that going on within the story, it is primarily a pacifist view of the world that the book wants to present. And choosing the Mennonites, I thought was a very strange thing for a science fiction writer to do. But nevertheless, it enables him to have that sort of pacifist concept in there.
And I think there's also, there was, in several places, there was a lot of sociological content. One, because Roscoe, while he is in prison, decides to educate himself and to study the same thing that his father did, which was sociology.
Yeah.
And then also the Martians get to come in and make several statements about, you know, human society. So in their society, once a year, they turn off the lights, or was it once a week? They turn off all the lights across the planet so you can see the stars.
Yeah.
And the other two notable things are, is they're still living inside domes. And so they're in highly controlled, highly vulnerable environments. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there is surveillance all over the place so that no one has the ability to commit a crime against another person or against the community without being observed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's significant because the nuclear war that happens on the Earth is started by smaller second world countries that then develop nuclear weapons and use them.
Yes. Yeah.
So it was kind of it was an indictment against really our current society and the things that we do.
Oh yeah, very much. And it had a sort of a Star Trek feel to it in the way that those aliens, I mean, as we've said, they're really Earth people from hundreds of years ago, but those right. people who've come from Mars have really come to lecture and finger wag at people on Earth. I mean, they could have just ignored what was going on on Earth and never visited, but for some reason they were drawn back to come and sort of interfere. And so that felt quite Star Trek-y to me. And I'm not thinking of what Starfleet does, I'm thinking of those alien races that keep turning up in Star Trek and judging Captain Kirk or Picard or whoever it is. So that was both the strength of this piece and a weakness. It was a weakness because it's too familiar, it's a bit corny. But the strength of it is it's yet another familiar trope piled on top of all these other familiar tropes. And I suppose, thinking about it, I called it a Star Trek-y thing to do. It's also a Day the Earth Stood Still sort of thing to do, isn't it? When Klaatu and Gort come to Earth and basically say, you're bad people.
Yeah, put away your nuclear weapons. Yeah. Bad things are going to happen.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts on the Downloaded?
You know, despite all the nits that I'm picking and everything else, I did enjoy it. You know, I like the full cast recording. I really, once I realized we were having sci-fi bingo, I was kind of into it and got into that groove. And it's an interesting story overall. It's not one that I'd come across. While there are bits and pieces of it that are similar, this narrative is very unique, and I did like it.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. And I found myself wanting to listen to the next episode. Originally, I was going to ration myself to one per day. But on the first day, I listened to two. And then the next day, I listened to two. And I started listening to a third. So it does draw you in. And I like the overall structure of the piece, that it feels as if it's moving somewhere. A lot of these science fiction serials that you hear in audio drama, and I'm thinking particularly the sort of amateur ones that are done as podcasts, you don't actually have such good quality storytelling. And I think this one is well structured, certainly well performed. That I think there was one character where I thought the performance was frankly dreadful, but most of the cast, and it's quite a big cast, were really very good, very good characterizations, distinctive voices. And it was, as you said, I think you said earlier, that it was so easy to tell one character from another. They were very distinct, both in terms of performance and the way they were written. So yeah, very good. I think I mentioned earlier that there is to be a conventional novel from this, which is coming out in May. And I looked on Amazon, and it is listed there as a paperback, but it's not available as yet for pre-order, but it will be soon. So it's coming out in May.
Let's do a quiz.
Please.
I found this quiz, but I have not yet taken it, so we can take it at the same time.
Oh, okay.
All right. I'll just read this out loud, although you can also give the link to people in the podcast notes if they want to follow along.
Yeah.
So question one is, in which medium did the science fiction genre begin? And you can choose from film, literature, and comic books.
Well, I'm going to say literature.
That looks correct. Question two, true or false? Science fiction stories only include technology that actually exists. True or false?
Definitely false.
Yeah. Which of the following is often said to be an early example of science fiction? Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, Paradise Lost by John Milton, Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan.
That'll be Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
Yes. Question four, true or false? The science fiction and fantasy genres have nothing in common, and a story can never include elements from both genres.
Let me ponder that for a moment. Well, obviously false, because I can think of many things that combine elements of both. I'm the first bit. Science fiction and fantasy genres have nothing in common. To be honest, I do tend to believe that. I do think they are separate things. But the second part is clearly nonsense. A story can never include elements from both. Well, we know all sorts of stories that include elements of both. And I would point you to Star Wars, for example.
Exactly.
Yep.
Question 5 of 7. Science fiction and fantasy are often considered to be part of what broader category of fiction? Reflective, inquisitive, or speculative?
Well, the answer is speculative, but I'm quite happy with the others as well, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, they would make for more interesting stories.
Yeah.
And question 6. Which of the following is a common topic in science fiction? Extraterrestrials, time travel, intergalactic travel, or all of the above?
Oh, thank heaven for the last answer. Yeah, all of the above.
Yes. Given the audiobook that we just read especially.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. Generally speaking, science fiction is distinguished from fantasy by using what elements as part of its story, plot, or setting? Science and technology, or magic and mysticism?
Let me think. Science fiction must be science and technology.
Yeah. All right. You got 7 out of 7.
I did. So, that is a quiz from dictionary.com.
It is.
And it's called Quiz Yourself on Sci-Fi Facts, Cyborgs Welcome. So, hey, that was good. That was quite easy, though, I have to say, especially because they made it multiple choice, but that's all right.
Sure. And that wasn't one of those medium quality quizzes that I sometimes, you know, spend time making up. You got a full quality one this time, even if it was easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I do have a quick off-topic question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you play Wordle because you post the responses on Facebook.
Yeah.
Do you play Connections?
I do. Yes.
Because I found a site, because there are also sites that let you make your own Wordle puzzles.
Yeah.
I found a site that lets you make your own connection puzzles.
Okay.
And I almost whipped one of those up, but I'm like, that, I don't know if that would work well in a podcast, but...
No, it's a bit too visual, isn't it? Because you've got to see the pattern, the visual pattern.
But I'd like you to think about this. I'd like you to think about you coming up with your own set of connections, sets of words, and we could create that connection puzzle and send it out to our listeners.
Ooh.
And give them a little challenge.
Yeah.
Now, there's no feedback from this site. I can't tell how many people take it or how many people got it right, but it might be a little interesting thing for people to do.
Yeah. Yeah, we should have a go at that. I'm always complaining that Connections, the official New York Times Connections, is too easy, because most of the time it is. The only times I ever get it wrong is when it is when it's dependent on some aspect of American culture that I'm not familiar with. And that usually means baseball or ice hockey. But Otherwise, you know, I find them very easy. So it would be a challenge to come up with one of my own, but also to come up with one that is a bit tougher than the official ones. So yeah, oh. Let's do it.
Well, yeah, maybe you could come up with one that's a little more British oriented to make us give us a more international flair.
Yeah, full of cricket and what else do we have? Tea.
Oh, no, but it'd have to be science fiction tea and science fiction cricket.
Shall we move on to past, present, and future?
Yes.
I've got a past item. It's not very past, but I suppose by the time this podcast goes out, it is definitely past. And that is the scandal over the Hugo Awards, which were awarded, well, they were awarded every year at the Worldcon, obviously. And last year, the Worldcon was held in China. And the scandal is such that even The Guardian, which is, you know, just a mainstream UK newspaper, has reported on this Hugo scandal. So, and for anyone who hasn't heard this, basically what's happened is that the full nomination data for the Hugos, not the final vote, but the original nominations where people put things forward for the shortlist, all of that data has now been published. And there were a few, well, more than a few, puzzling anomalies in the data. And in particular, several works that were nominated were discarded as being not eligible. And all the organisers would say is that it was not eligible when we applied the rules. And of course, people are all a little bit suspicious, especially when it turns out that some or all of the ineligible works happened to have been written by people who were either directly or indirectly critical of the Chinese government. So it's a little bit, a little bit suspect, I find.
Yeah, I was disappointed in that. I've been reading everything I can about it to try and learn more.
Yeah.
And at one point, somebody mentioned that in the July newsletter from Chengdu, that they said that they were going to use more than the Worldcon constitution as laws for choosing which nominations were valid and invalid. Hmm. And so I went back and I downloaded it because it's still online. And sure enough, it says that they would be using all local laws to validate nominations. And so that, in conjunction with a very interesting piece that I found from a File 770 commenter about the nature of when you block something from being discussed.
Censorship?
Yeah, the nature of censorship.
Yeah.
And how, and they brought up 1984 and a lot of other just interesting topics that, while people think that the Chinese government may have been directly involved in stepping on some of those nominations, it's possible that just the overall censorship caused people to take actions to prevent them from having problems with the government and that nothing was...
Yeah, yeah.
But it's hard to tell because no one's talking.
Yes, that's right. Oh, well, the few people who are talking are simply repeating the same message that we applied the rules. And yeah, I don't think that's satisfactory. I mean, it's nothing to do with me. I didn't even have a membership, so I've got no right to comment. But these awards are considered to be significant because publishers will put it on the cover of the book, you know, Hugo Award winner. So there is some impact from receiving a Hugo. And so, yeah, it's all a bit dodgy, as we say over here.
Yeah, it tarnishes the reputation of something that the community or a large section of the community respects.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any past items?
I do, and they're all thematically related, my past, present, and future items. I have one of each.
Okay.
My past item is that Dune Part 1 was re-released to theaters on January 24th.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking forward to Dune Part 2, by the time you hear this podcast, it'll be too late to watch it again. But apparently, Denis Villeneuve's Dune is a major event, and so it gets a re-release.
Hmm. Do you think they're re-releasing it in order to prime people for watching part two?
Oh, definitely.
Right.
Right. I mean, in a way, if you think about it, we have three different Dunes going on.
Hmm.
There's the story. There is the David Lynch Dune. There's the sci-fi miniseries Dune.
Oh,
and now
yes.
There's Denis' Dune. So technically there's four of them. Yeah. And to make sure that you know which one we're going to be seeing in March 1st, they want to have that story fresh in people's minds.
That's a good move. Should we go on to present items?
Yes.
A very brief one from me to begin with. I've got a couple of others as well. But now we're in 2024. Do you know which science fiction movie we must be living in?
Oh, I'm drawing a blank.
Oh, it's A Boy and His Dog.
Oh. Another post-apocalyptic.
Yep. Give me your present item, or one of them.
February 18th and 19th, if you go to theaters, you can watch the Fathom Events re-release of David Lynch's Dune, because this year is the 40th anniversary.
Okay. So if you want to confuse yourself by watching the wrong prequel to the forthcoming sequel.
Or if you want to compare and contrast, you know, this year's Dune and the Dune of 40 years ago for storytelling and plot and technology and CGI.
Yeah. I've got another present item. This is really a suggestion to people. Go and join a book group. I'm in two book groups online. And, not only are there online book groups, of course, there are in-person book groups. So lots of libraries, lots of colleges have reading groups or book groups. And I always recommend people to join them. It's only in the last couple of years that I've joined book groups because it's just something I never would have bothered with in the before times. But since there are so many online ones now, I find it a very good way of receiving some encouragement to read. But you have to choose the right group, of course. I happen to be in two book groups, and they're both very geographically distant from where I am, but they discuss some very interesting things. So I recommend everybody has a go. The general science fiction one that I'm in is out of Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh!
Which I've never been to. And it's probably not even pronounced Worcester. It's probably pronounced Worcester.
No, it's Worcester.
Oh, is it?
I've been there.
Oh, good. Have you?
Yeah. Worcester is the home to the best disc golf course in the entire world.
Oh, well, there you go. It's also home to one of the best science fiction book groups, which is run by the librarian Melody Friedenthal. And through that book group in recent times, I've read some authors that I've never read before, and also caught up with some books that I'd missed by familiar authors. And some of those authors have come into the book group, which has been quite nice. There's no guarantee that there will always be an author present, but Alan Steele came along when we were discussing one of his books. I'd never read anything of his before. And John Scalzi came along when we discussed one of his books. So unfortunately, Octavia Butler couldn't make it on account of having died a couple of decades ago.
Scheduling difficulties.
Yeah. But yeah, join a book group, folks. They're good fun.
So that leaves the future for us to talk about.
Yeah. Give me your future. I bet it's to do with Dune.
It is. And I kind of gave the lead out earlier. Dune 2, the second half of Denis Villeneuve's Dune duology, comes out March 1st.
Mm-hmm. I guess I should watch the first one. And then I guess I should watch the second one. I'm not a huge fan of Dune. I tried to read the book probably about 30 years ago. And I didn't like it at all. I'm sure I've seen the David Lynch film a couple of times, but again, it's not really my cup of tea. I like David Lynch as a rule, but not too keen on that particular film. And I just haven't seen the Villeneuve take. So, but I should do, because I like Denis Villeneuve's films, so I should. My future item is... I always hesitate to talk about films that have been announced because quite often they never actually get made. But there has been another announcement about a new Star Trek film, and Bad Robot, which is J.J. Abrams' company, It says it's producing an origin story for the next Star Trek film, and it's going to be set decades before Star Trek 2009. And they've attached a director to the project. They have Toby Haynes, who is from Andor and Doctor Who. So that could be good.
An origin story?
Yeah.
But wasn't Star Trek... Well, I mean, if someone actually made another Star Trek movie, which really hasn't happened yet, right? Yeah. In 2009, that's the origin of the original series. So what other origin... Yeah.
I know. It occurred to me that it could be the origin of the Enterprise, but I think we saw it being constructed in Star Trek 2009. So in a sense, we've already had that, unless it was being rebuilt or something. But the other thing, it could be an origin story of Starfleet or the Federation. Again, you could say we've had that because that was Enterprise, the TV series. But who knows? I think it's going to be somewhere between Enterprise and, well, the first mission of NCC 1701, you know, the famous Enterprise. But who knows?
I guess we'll just have to see if they make it and then watch it and find out.
I guess we will. Any more?
Nope, I'm good.
Good. So, in that case, I shall say thanks for listening, folks. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. And our theme tune is from Purple Planet at purpleplanet.com. Check out the show notes at 101sf.blogspot.com. And please give us a glowing 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. And we'll see you next time.